The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Sean Spicer looks at the Sanders problem.
The more that it is Bernie, especially through Super Tuesday, the more that the Democratic Party is going to freak out.
We look back at a media prediction from 2016.
If the unlikely event happens and Trump wins, you will see a market crash of historic proportions.
Tom Cotton discusses the coronavirus.
The Chinese Communist Party needs to be transparent about exactly what transpired in Wuhan in the November to December timeframe.
And a former Sanders supporter was surprised by what she found at a Trump rally.
We've developed this caricature of who a Trump supporter is that is just completely out of touch with who they actually are.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Mike Bloomberg must have been thinking about Julius Caesar on the way to the forum when he got done with the debate on Wednesday night. My, that was an ugly affair for the former mayor of New York.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats are not going to win.
There were many fireworks, though. In midweek, the Democrats took to the debate stage just to slay at each other. It was the first time that Bernie Sanders had arrived as the clear front runner.
Those are some of the reasons we have the strongest campaign to defeat Donald Trump.
He left as the same. And at the same time, America got a long first look at former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Mayor Bloomberg, should you exist?
I can't speak for all billionaires. All I know is I've been very lucky, made a lot of money.
Since the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, Bernie Sanders has been the clear leader of the Democrats running for president. Throughout the week, most polls showed him with a double-digit lead on the rest of the field, including the quickly sinking Joe Biden. One poll also revealed Sanders' defeat of all other candidates in a one-on-one matchup against each of them. So where does this leave the Democratic Party? In a panic and in near ruin. I spoke with former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
I have already voted because I'm a Virginian and I will not be in state on 3-3, so I have an excused absentee. They gave me my ballot. I voted for Bernie. And I did so because I want
to... Hold on. Can I just stop for a second? Because as someone who's lived in Virginia for 20-what years, I thought to myself, what am I missing? I don't think there's an election. And then I realized what you just said.
Yeah, it's absolutely. You get to walk in and ask for either ballots, an open primary. The law allows it, and therefore it is not unjust or wrong in any way to participate. And I want to set up the clearest choice possible, which I think is Bernie. Now, he is not the easiest person to beat. That's Elizabeth Warren. In fact, Joe Biden's easier to beat. Bernie could be tough to beat, but it does set up a clear choice, and we might disabuse the next generation of the evils of socialism if we get it out front and really talk about it. That's my motive. Will you vote in the Democratic primary, Sean Spicer?
I will tell you this. I have never done that in my life, but I take what you say very seriously, and in the last 16 seconds, I've gone going, you know, maybe he's got something there. So I am... There's something about not, I don't know, I this is a moral dilemma for me that I will have to think about. But I get your point, and I think more to that point, look, I agree with you. Every one of these people has some way, shape, or form said, you know, I'm leaning to the socialist side of the Democratic Party. Bernie, though, is unabashed about it. He's very clear, and I think that in so many ways, he epitomizes it, he exemplifies it. And so having that binary choice, come November is excellent, because the thing is that Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden will say the code words to the Democrats to get their vote. But then when they go to a general, we'll kind of be like, what are you talking about? I'm not a socialist and I don't believe in that. Bernie actually will continue to embrace it. And I think that's beautiful. So I think that I agree with you wholeheartedly. The more that it is Bernie, the better. And frankly, the more that it is Bernie, especially through Super Tuesday, the more that the Democratic Party is going to freak out because the establishment elite cannot stand him. And then the younger voters, ironically, this is nuts, but those sort of the rabid supporters and activists are going to go nuts if they think this thing's getting stolen. So I think in either way, if Bernie's the number two or the number one, it sets up a construct that is so beautiful for us heading into a convention.
And an open primary, I'm getting a lot of heat, not a lot of heat, but some Democrat. How immoral, you're a Democrat, impose posture. Look, open primaries, I hate them, but Democrats have used them to screw around with the Republican primaries for years because whatever the legislature of the state in which you live, if they choose to have an open primary, they are saying they want you to participate. It's absolutely moral. It is absolutely fine for people to go in and express their desire for what they would like to see the ballot be in November. And if they want to change every state to close primary, I'm all in favor of that. I think, you know, I'm a Republican from day one. This is the second time I voted for a Democrat in my life. The first time was for John Graham in an open primary when I knew he would lose in the general. But he's a friend of mine, an academic. I like the guy. But I just believe if open primaries are there, if the legislature of the state invites you to participate, you ought to participate. That's my view of the thing.
And I think it comes down to how they state that, right? And so back in the day, that if you went to a Republican primary in Virginia, it said that I agree that I'll support the nominee in the general. I mean, you had to just sign it. It was your oath, not the law.
That is not the case.
Right, right, right. And that's what I'm saying. I think it depends on how they frame it. And you're right. If the state legislature sets it up with no restrictions and says, hey, anybody can come in and do this, we don't care, then that's vastly different.
Even with the coronavirus causing some instability in the stock market, the numbers under the Trump administration are up. Way up. Do you remember the doom and gloom coming from many of those in the media? Some outright predicted a market crash if Trump defeated Hillary. Who could have imagined that the economy would be so robust that a certain former president is seeking credit for it? Here's Salem syndicated talker Larry Elder.
President Trump is swiping back at former President Barack Obama, who's taking credit for the Trump economy. Obama tweeted, quote, 11 years ago today, near the bottom of the worst recession in generations, I signed the Recovery Act, paving the way for more than a decade of economic growth and the longest streak of job creation in American history, end of quote. President Trump's national press secretary responded, quote, President Trump reversed every single failed Obama-era economic policy and with it reversed the floundering Obama-Biden economy. Obama and Biden orchestrated the worst economic recovery in modern history, end of quote. Let's explore this, shall we? Now, what you hear over and over and over again is how Obama laid the foundation for the Trump economy. But for the wonderful things that Obama did, Lord knows where we would be. May I remind you of some of the things that so-called experts like Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and experts like Paul Krugman, the economist who also writes a column for the New York Times, both predicted economic disaster in the event that President Trump came in.
And great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And let's put politics aside. We're just talking about this notion on the street that seems to be fairly prevalent out there that a Trump presidency could actually hurt stocks. What you're calling for, though, is very dramatic and drastic, a 50% decline over his presidency, which would be 4 years. So let's get through the back of the envelope calculations here. How do you get there?
That it would definitely fall. Yes, and for two reasons. I mean, you saw it when the Comey emails came out. We saw what the market did. And so there's Trump's temperament, which I think is a significant issue for the market. Whenever you have a I would handicap, if Trump wins, I would handicap the likelihood that the probability that he would say something stupid and offensive during a four-year term multiple times at 100%.
So this is because markets were reassured that Hillary Clinton was doing well?
Yeah, look, markets would be very destabilized by a Trump victory. Mm-hmm. Particularly if the
likely event happens and Trump wins, you will see a market crash of historic proportions, I think.
They are forecasting that if Donald Trump was to be elected, that there would be a rout on the stock market and a rout on the dollar.
I mean, I have my Trump hedge on. In the event Donald wins, I have no doubt in my mind the market tanks.
Now, the reason this is relevant is because Donald Trump, of course, a plan to reverse Obamacare, lower taxes, lower corporate taxes. Those are not the kinds of things his opponent was promising. So therefore, they assumed that by doing those things, it was going to crash the economy. I find it fascinating that Obama and the Democrats are taking credit for this economy. Remember what they said that Trump would do to the economy? And how many times have you heard them say that President Trump has been, quote, undoing Obama's legacy? If he's undoing Obama's legacy, how do you take credit for having undone his legacy? Left-wing black host of shows on PBS and on NPR. Tavis Smiley in 2016.
I'm sad to report that in every single leading economic category, Black America has lost ground over the last decade. In every major economic category, we've lost ground. So this book comes out, as you said, in 2006. So clearly, this book was out before Obama shows up to win in 2008. So the book was never about Barack Obama then. This 10-year update is not about him now. But it is true that over these last 10 years, most of that on his watch, Black America has lost ground in the major economic indicator categories.
Now, does Trump get any credit? This is BET founder Bob Johnson last July.
I'm wondering, given your position in the U.S. and your familiarity with what many have called Trump's brinksmanship when it comes to politics, talk me through a little bit how do you feel about the economy today?
Well, I think the economy is doing absolutely great. And so African-American unemployment is at its lowest level, Hispanic unemployment, women. So I give President Trump, and I've said this before on Squawk Box, I give President a lot of credit for moving the economy in a positive direction that's benefiting a large number of Americans.
Tom Steyer, a billionaire, a late entrant into the race, appeared on ABC's Sunday Chat Show, and he started downplaying the Trump economy. And surprisingly, Martha Raddatz, the host, pushed back a couple of times.
Mr. Steyer, you say that you can take on Donald Trump on the economy. But the latest Quinnipiac National Poll, again released just this week, says 70% of voters describe the nation's economy as excellent or good. So how do you convince them that a change is needed when they think they're doing so well under Donald Trump?
I think if you take a look at what he says, everything he says superficially sounds right, but is actually a lie. So when he says the economy's growing, I can show that, in fact, all the money's going to rich people.
But I want to go back to that 70% number. You talk about the wealthy. They're not all wealthy people. 70% say the economy is good and they're doing well.
Well, I'm just saying, here we are on a show, and you're standing up for Mr. Trump's version of the economy.
I'm telling you about a national poll. I'm not standing up for anybody. I'm telling you about a national poll.
Coming up, Senator Tom Cotton.
The Chinese Communist Party needs to be transparent about exactly what transpired in Wuhan in the November to December timeframe.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The coronavirus has now afflicted over 75,000 lives. It's proved fatal to over 2,000 souls, nearly all of them in China. Early reports of the virus put the blame squarely on a so-called wet market in downtown Wuhan, but then emerged studies suggesting that could not be the case. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton and many others raised questions about the origins of the virus. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Now, it turns out that both the People's Republic of China and MSNBC are mad at you, and they're accusing you of peddling conspiracy theories. What are they talking about, Tom Cotton? What is your response?
Hugh, I have to say that the
fake news media seems angrier at me for raising questions about the origins of the coronavirus than they are at the Chinese Communist Party for contributing to this huge mess to begin with. So from the very beginning, after China, remember, finally acknowledged that they had a problem in Wuhan, which they hid for many weeks, which would have, if we had known, would have allowed us to get further ahead of the virus. The Chinese Communist Party said it originated in a food market in Wuhan, yet an authoritative study in The Lancet, the respected international science journal, by Chinese scientists refuted that almost conclusively. 14 of the original 41 cases had no contact with that food market whatsoever. So we still don't know the origins of this coronavirus. Now, I have merely pointed out for several weeks now that China's only biosafety level 4 laboratory dealing with human infectious diseases is just a few miles away from that laboratory. Now, I don't know where this virus originated. Natural causes, somewhere other than that food market, is still the most likely hypothesis. But given the Chinese Communist Party's record of dishonesty and incompetence in managing this crisis, we at least have to ask the question whether or not it's connected to that laboratory and demand that international scientists be admitted to study the evidence, both in the food market and the laboratory and in those original cases, especially the original 14 cases that had no contact with the food market, if we want to get our hands around how this virus originated and what that can tell us about diagnosing it and trying to treat it.
Is it a reasonable expectation of the WHO and international bodies to be allowed admittance to the facility that you've referred to, Senator Cotton?
Yes, of course, Hugh, and especially given the dire situation that China now faces and that China is increasingly spreading to the world. By some measures, more than 750 million people in China are now living under some version of quarantine or at least restricted movement. Think about that. 750 million people, more than twice the population of the United States of America. And these cases are continuing to spread around the world. And when there are so many unknown variables at play here, not just the origin, but how fast the virus can replicate, how long it takes to incubate, what its mortality rate will be, it is incumbent upon China to open itself up to reputable, respected scientists and doctors from around the world to help them figure out what we're going to do about this virus.
Now, the story of the morning from the South China Morning Post is, quote, coronavirus up to 20 times more likely than SARS to bind to human cells, study suggests, close quote. At the same time, there's an op-ed in the New York Times that says the mortality rate, as best we can tell thus far, is 2.5%. Have you talked to the CDC, and are the CDC and the NIH being welcomed with open arms by the People's Republic of China anywhere and everywhere they need to go to help?
No, Hugh, of course not. China continues to exclude most Americans from mainland China. They continue to dissemble and be substantially less than transparent in getting the information out that we need, getting access that we need. And as you say, hopefully the mortality rate will remain at 2.5% and not grow to what it was with SARS. But if the infection rate is several times higher than it was with SARS, even at 2.5% mortality, you're still talking about a widespread pandemic around the world that could kill tens, if not hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions.
So I want to underscore, nothing that you have said undermines the widespread belief that the virus jumped from animals to humans. Nothing that you have said. You're not in any way attempting to discredit that, but you were asking the Chinese government to be transparent about everything and everyone involved with the initial outbreak so that we might better understand origins and might better develop cures and vaccines, correct?
That is correct, Hugh, that the Chinese Communist Party needs to be transparent about exactly what transpired in Wuhan in the November to December timeframe. And the way to do that is to open itself up completely to a team of international scientists to study the matter.
Dr. Carolyn Borsenko is a lifelong Democrat, but she recently wrote an article that went viral. The title, "After Attending a Trump Rally, I Realize Democrats Are Not Ready for 2020. She spoke with Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson on Chicago's Morning Answer AM 560.
You had a bit of a moment of intellectual curiosity that led you all the way to a Trump rally in New Hampshire. you know, explain that and explain what your perceptions were going in versus what you experienced coming out.
Yeah, well, even to back up a little bit, I was a Bernie Sanders supporter in 2016, and I kind of plugged my nose and voted for Hillary. But no, I think, you know, after I witnessed the vitriol in the knitting community, and it's still going on, I'm still getting attacked today for all this stuff, it really made me question who I aligned myself politically with. And when I started questioning that, it just opens up this floodgate of other things that I hadn't considered before. And so I started making, about 6 months ago, a proactive effort to start listening to voices I thought I would disagree with, just to try to understand their perspective and see the world through their eyes. And, you know, New Hampshire politics is a really fun thing to be around. We're very spoiled. And I had gone to see every single major Democratic candidate at one point or another. And Trump was there with his rally the day before the New Hampshire primary. And I thought, you know what? Why not? If nothing else, it's going to be a complete spectacle.
Okay. And what did you take away from that first Trump rally?
Well, the thing is, going into it, the people in my life, I mean, both liberal and conservative, were genuinely afraid for my safety when I told them I was going to this Trump rally. The very first thing when I was waiting in line to get into the arena was that everyone was just so nice, and they were so just average, everyday people. They were people that, you know, you meet on the street and you just never think about, oh, they're an evil Trump supporter. We've developed this caricature of who a Trump supporter is and what they believe that is just completely out of touch with who they actually are.
And you write in your piece too, the energy there, and just, it was, since you are a veteran rally goer, you have some frame of reference, and it was an energy that you've never experienced before.
No, it was so joyous and happy and fun. It was like being at a rock concert. I mean, I went to Barack Obama's events in New Hampshire in 2008, and it was Trump's rally was so far beyond what I experienced even at Obama's rally. And so it was an incredibly fun experience.
You say in your piece that you think Democrats come November that they don't even see coming. And I wonder if what you just described is at least one of the reasons why you think that.
You know, I've heard from so many people who are trying to get their friends who are Democrats to read the article, and they just won't do it. They won't even take in information that is outside of their worldview. And I think that they've created these bubbles around themselves where they just don't want to acknowledge the broader reality. I think November is going to be a shock for them. And frankly, I think that they've got it coming.
Coming up, old audio gets Bloomberg in trouble with fellow Democrats.
And the way she has it done on the kids' hands is to throw them against the wall and frisk them. Because then they start, they say, oh, I don't want to get caught, so they don't bring the gun. They still have a gun, but they leave it at home.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Former Mayor Michael Bloomberg has tried to distance himself from that audio on Stop and Frisk. At the same time, he enjoys telling people how his policies as mayor reduced gun violence. Heather McDonald is the author of a book, War on Cops. She has studied policies like Stop and Frisk and whether or not they have been successful in lowering crime. McDonald spoke with Salem host Larry Elder.
Heather, I'm sure you've seen the 2015 tape in which Bloomberg clumsily and unlawfully describes what stop, question, and frisk really is. First of all, I want your reaction to that tape.
Well, one thing that's interesting is he gave these remarks at the Aspen Institute, which is about the most left-wing, mainstream elite institution in the country. He was speaking inartfully, but the basic factual underpinnings of what he said with regards to the distribution of criminal victimization in New York City and the deterrent effect of proactive policing was true. And none of the people who were denouncing him for racism, and I deplore both Trump and his enablers and retinue that are using the racism charge against Bloomberg, none of them have offered facts to disprove what Bloomberg's core factual basis was.
I think, Heather, that Trump's argument would be, and I have no idea if he'd make this argument. I know I would make it if I were Trump. The reason I called Bloomberg racist is because Bloomberg simply suggested because you're a minority, because you're young, you can, quote, be thrown up against the wall, close quote. He never mentioned the magic words reasonable suspicion. That's what I think prompted Trump to say what he said. At least that's how I would defend it if I were then called hypocritical, because, as you know, Trump supported stop, question, and frisk.
Well, you know, if he really meant that, obviously that is unacceptable, mm-hmm. and that is making judgments about people on a completely outrageous ground. My guess is that he was using shorthand, and I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe right. he does not deserve that benefit of the doubt, but that is not what the police were doing. They were not, you know, there were millions of minority males in New York City of only a fraction of those were stopped and questioned, and they were those stops occurred in crime hotspots, in shooting hotspots, driven by community demands to try and get the guns off the street.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what's most important here is the challenge to that very effective and very necessary police tactic, rather than dealing with, well, what was Bloomberg really getting at that point.
You point out in your column, Heather, that there was a 2018 study by the National Academy of Sciences, and they concluded that stop, question, and frisk actually lowers crime. A criminologist you write about in 2015 found that the NYPD's use of the tactic had, in fact, deterred crime. And also the co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice System pretty much said the same thing.
Well, and these are all leftists.
Right.
I mean, the Stanford professor is about as left as it gets, and I'm frankly amazed that he was quoted to that effect, but he certainly was. So, yes, obviously stop, question, and frisk. It is constitutional. I mean, that is one of the myths that have been put out there in the wake of Bloomberg's mayoralty, that somehow it has been ruled unconstitutional. That is simply not the case.
Right.
The judge who ruled that the NYPD's practice was unconstitutional was removed from the case for her outright bias. The ruling was a joke. She ignored clearly relevant facts. She excluded them from the courtroom, from the record. But it's constitutional. It needs to be used, as you say, Larry, with reasonable suspicion, with reasonable grounds. But officers, by and large, have those grounds. They're looking at behavior. They're looking at crime environment to temporarily ask a possibly criminal suspect a few questions. And if the suspect answers those questions in a way to allay the officer's suspicions, he's allowed to go on his way.
Right.
If he doesn't, the officer may frisk him and make further inquiries.
Heather, you point out in your article, 97% of all the shootings in New York in 2018 were done by blacks or Hispanics.
Even that's a fact.
Whites are 34% of the city, but make up just 2.8% of the shooting suspects.
And how do we know this, Larry? Not from the allegedly racist police. We know this because that is what the victims of and witnesses to those shootings and homicides report to the police. And those victims and witnesses are themselves overwhelmingly black and Hispanic. So nobody with any shred of good faith can charge that those statistics are somehow the product of a racist criminal justice system.
Coming up, the insanity of letting boys compete against girls.
Two males began to compete with them in the girls' leagues and now hold 15 women's state championship titles that were once held by 9 different girls.
How the girls are fighting back when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom.
The issues surrounding minors declaring that they are transitioning genders are complicated and sensitive. Alliance Defending Freedom finds itself defending the rights of those on the sidelines of those controversies, or in this case, on the field of play. In the state of Connecticut, two boys who now identify as girls are competing as athletes as girls. They are dominating in a sport where competing against other boys, they are average, but they are dominating when they compete as girls. ADF stepped in and filed a lawsuit on behalf of three top female runners in the state. Senior counsel Kristen Wagoner explained the situation to my friend and colleague Dennis Prager.
The male bodies have set all the female records in high school track in that state. Tell my listeners about it.
Well, we represent three Connecticut female athletes who run track there, all under the same athletic association. And they're all three champions in their own right. They have established records, have won a number of races. And what happened was two males began to compete with them in the girls' leagues and now hold 15 women's state championship titles that were once held by 9 different girls, including one of our clients, for example, has lost 4 girls' state championships and 2 all New England awards to a boy who actually 3 weeks prior to joining the girls' competition ran as a boy in Connecticut.
3 weeks earlier he ran in the male competition, but he figured, I'll do better in the female, so I'll say I'm female.
Well, whatever he figured, what we know is that girls deserve to compete on a level playing
field.
Yes,
exactly. So let me just, first of all, have these girls been the subject or object of attacks for going to court?
You know, I think it depends on which day you ask them. Have people said things to them? Has one of them thinks that they experienced some retaliation? Do we have a claim? Yes, and we're pursuing that. But they also have received a lot of support from the other girls that they're going to school with and from their colleagues in their classes. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag there in Connecticut, but thankfully they have each other, and they're very, very brave young women to take a stand.
Why is Connecticut, by the way, the example? What goes on there?
Well, I think it's a matter of where, you know, girls are, it takes a lot of bravery. It's hard for young girls to stand up and to say this isn't right. They want to be compassionate to their fellow students. They don't want to come across and they're being told, you know, you're hateful or this or that. And so they're concerned about how they're perceived. But these three women have had such courage in being willing to stand and say, I'm not just standing for myself, for my own championships that I've missed out on, but for the girls that are coming behind me. And so that's the main reason it started in Connecticut. These policies are in other states as well, and I'll guarantee you this isn't the end of the litigation. There will be other lawsuits.
Has it gone to any court yet?
Not yet.
So I morally and rationally, it's not even an issue. But legally, if Connecticut says you are the gender, as they now call it, you are the sex you identify as, what is your legal argument?
Well, there's a federal statute called Title IX, and it requires that girls be given equal opportunities in athletics. It says that you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, and that's a federal law. It's not a state law. Under the regulations that have to do with Title IX, it even spells it out more clearly to say that the schools need to be providing athletic opportunities that are of equal quality to girls and women as to boys and men, and that accommodates the specific abilities of girls. And we know that in many sports, there are basic physiological differences between the sexes that are just a reality and have to be taken into account. So the league, as well as the public schools, they're violating federal law by discriminating on the basis of sex against these girls.
They're discriminating on the basis of sex by doing what?
By allowing biological boys to compete, to take athletic opportunities, to take places,
is the issue then which takes preponderance, federal or state law?
Well, that's not an issue because we know it's federal law.
Are you in a state court? You're obviously in a state court to begin with, correct?
No, we're in a federal court.
Oh, you are. Okay. What would they have to rule? That biology is all that dictates who competes against whom?
No, there are many different ways that a court could rule on a final solution, but essentially what we're asking is, particularly in track, biological differences matter, and so those who are males need to compete against men, and those who are girls need to compete against girls. What we know from even just looking at basic scores and run times is that the best female athletes in track and field are beaten regularly
by hundreds of high school boys. By the way, I don't know if this is on your radar. It's on mine. The silence of feminist groups with regard to this issue.
Well, and not only silence, but some of the groups are coming out in favor of boys taking spots from girls.
Do you have any names?
Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, abortion rights groups. They've all.
Wait, what? What do abortion rights groups have to do with who races against whom?
I think it does get to a deeper issue of biological differences in men and women and when those differences matter. I can't speak to what those groups are saying, but I will tell you there are a number of radical feminist groups that actually are lining up with us and that have filed friend of the court briefs.
Do you have any names, any of those names?
Wolf is one group that has been tremendously helpful to us.
Wolf?
Yes, Wolf, W-O-L-F.
Right.
And they actually participated in a number of events and have really brought this to the forefront and have taken tremendous heat as a result. And I think they're hoping to rally others. And you may have seen, there was an op-ed with Maria Navratilova and other female.
Well, Maria Navratilova has been excommunicated from the LGBTQ. Martina Navratilova's been excommunicated.
Right. There are heavy penalties to pay if you stand up for fair play for girls. That's certainly true from the LGBT side of things. But what we ultimately know is that it is a women's rights issue. It should be a women's rights issue, given the 50 years of hard-fought victories that have been achieved. And really, this is rolling those back in many different ways.
Coming up, Dennis Prager reacts to Bloomberg's support of China.
We're dealing with a fool.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Environmentalists struggle to cope with the fact that most pollution entering the ocean is coming from China. Very little enters from the shores of the United States. So Mayor Bloomberg was quizzed on this very issue. His answer was shocking. It revealed a man who doesn't understand the dangers of communism. Here, once again, is Dennis Prager.
This is Bloomberg being questioned about his attitude toward the tyrants of China, the communist tyrants of China.
So the United States currently accounts for about 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Yes. China accounts for roughly 30% of greenhouse gas emissions. How do we, even if we get to net zero, how do you get China, India, and the other countries to be good partners?
China is doing a lot. Yes, they're still building a bunch of coal-fired power plants.
And they're still burning coal.
Yes, they are. But they are now moving plants away from the cities. The Communist Party wants to stay in power in China, and they listen to the public. When the public says, I can't breathe the air, Xi Jinping is not a dictator. He has to satisfy his constituents.
He is not the dictator of China. He's not a dictator.
Xi Jinping is not a dictator. He has to satisfy his constituents, or he's not going to survive.
Okay, this is. I'm speechless. Since when do dictators have to satisfy? Did Fidel Castro, who was in power 50 years, satisfy his constituents? Did Stalin satisfy his constituents? Did Mao? What dictator satisfies his constituents? All right, go on.
No, he has to. He has a constituency to answer to.
He doesn't have a vote. He doesn't have a democracy. He doesn't.
That
he's
doesn't
not
mean
held accountable
he can
by voters.
If his advisors gave
him, is the check on him just a revolution?
You're not going to have a revolution. Government survives without the will of the majority of its people.
Okay, we're dealing with a fool, which I do believe he is. No government survives without the support of the majority of its people? Then why not hold elections? Why do they fear elections? Putin, who is less a dictator than Xi in China, and is a dictator, but less so, he fears elections. He fears free and open elections. How come there's no free press in China? If he has the support of the majority of his people, what's the problem with the free press? But there will be no attacks from the Democrats on this because all of their attacks on Trump are phony. They're phony. They're to weaken Trump, not because they have principles. Their principle is get in power. Expand government as much as possible. We love power. This is an astonishing... This man is running for president of the United States?
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.